Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone, and live from the green space here at WNYC today. It's a special edition of our program. It's the Resistance at 1 year. This Saturday is the 1 year anniversary of the inauguration of Donald Trump. Sunday is the 1 year anniversary of the Women's March. Today, we focus on what the Women's March has spawned and other avenues of resistance to the racism, xenophobia, and misogyny that so many Americans experience the Trump administration to be fostering. And let's just say it, before we even get to policy, a president whose political success has been built on a foundation of, I call it, white Christian heterosexual cis male identity politics. There it is. In a way, everything else flows from that. We saw it again last week when the president promised on television to accept any bipartisan compromise on immigration that members of Congress could come up with. And then when they did, he decided it would alienate the harder core anti-immigrant base, so he rejected it. And of course, the headlines were about him saying S-hole countries and preferring Norway, but the underlying story that's gotten a little lost in the shuffle was his rejection of bipartisan deal making, exactly what the art of the deal candidate was supposed to stand for, in favor of keeping the angriest nativists in his base inflamed, because that's the only true underpinning of his power. Look at the polls. So how does a moral nation resist? And given the passive acquiescence of the Republican Congress in most cases, how does a resistance to bigotry and creeping authoritarianism, never mind ordinary policies that people don't like, exert power? How does the resistance exert power in the face of those things? We have many special guests today, beginning with our first four right now here on the Green Space stage. New York Times columnist Charles Blow, a leading resistance voice in print. He is also a CNN contributor. Catherine Semyonko, organizer of the first anniversary Women's March here in New York City this coming Saturday. And she is president of the Women's March Alliance and also organized last year's Women's March New York edition. L. Joy Williams, national political strategist, social justice activist. She is president of the Brooklyn NAACP and host of the podcast Sunday Civics. And Murad Awada, vice president of advocacy at the New York Immigration Coalition. Thank you all for coming and welcome to the Green Space. And listeners, when we're in the green space, you can see the show as well as listen, because we are set up here for live streaming video. So if you want to watch, the audience just saw me wave at the camera. If you want to watch the next wave, go to thegreenspace.org or wnyc.org and see our great guests. Charles, can we start on the news a little bit? Is your take any different from what I just laid out there about how we went so quickly from Tuesday's "I'll sign whatever bipartisan deal Congress brings and I won't say I want this or I want that," he said all those words, to Thursday's angry rejection of a bipartisan compromise that was delivered?
Right, but I think that both things are important, right? Because there is a tendency among the people who defend and support this president to say that I disagree with his style, and I disagree with the rhetoric, but I agree with the policies, and that those are two separate things. And what the president demonstrated in that meeting was that they are not separate at all, that he was delivering the poison in the middle of knocking down the policy. And so I think that's really important to push home, that there is no way to separate the way that he feels from the way that he is behaving. And the people who want that safe space, to want that bifurcation, you can't have it. It simply does not exist.
Murad, how does the New York Immigration Coalition view the deal that Dick Durbin and Lindsey Graham and the others brought to the president? It would allow the start of building the wall. It gives the president the first year funding on the 10-year wall money that he wants and end the visa lottery for underrepresented countries, if I understand correctly, in order to protect the Dreamers and people here from Haiti and El Salvador on temporary protected status. Deal or no deal?
I think it's not deal or no deal. I think we look at the actual package. It's reducing the diversity visa, limiting some of the family visa options, as well as how are we going to move forward with one of his biggest campaign promises was building this gigantic wall, which is not possible. That will be a huge waste of money. To move this conversation forward in a way that makes sense is not something that makes sense to the White House. So having this package come together as a bipartisan package, you know, we are a coalition of organizations. And a lot of our groups were, you know, a little bit astonished at how much was being given away to get the DREAM Act. And I think that that's something that continues to be at the forefront of our conversations with Senator Schumer and Democrats across the board, and also Republicans, is that we are not going to let this administration divide our communities further than they already are trying.
So you would have urged Senator Schumer and others to vote no on that deal as presented?
I don't think we would have urged them to vote no. We would have urged them to strip away as much as possible from what they were putting into that deal. And one thing we have to realize is, like, this is probably the only opportunity that we will have to do this. And when we're talking about how can we protect immigrants, I think that this is probably one way, but we don't want to provide protection for some and then create this whole other deportation force on the other hand either, because we're going to protect the Dreamers and then let their families and parents get scooped up in this huge enforcement ring that's being pushed through our country right now. Doesn't quite equal it doesn't level the playing field at all. It just creates even more uncertainty in our communities.
So for all of you, a year ago, two of the operative words were resist and don't normalize. And I wonder if everyone wants to just revisit the basics of how resistance somehow meant more than the usual opposition to a president you don't agree with on the issues, and what don't normalize was supposed to prevent. And are those still the central organizing principles today? Catherine, you want to start on that one?
Sure. It's not about resisting as much as it's about making your voice heard. We as women need to stand up. We as supporters of women need to stand up and say we matter, our voice matters, we will not be silenced, and we will not be shunned. And it's about standing up and making your voice heard. That in itself is an act of resistance, but it's not about resisting. It's about being heard and being represented.
Joy?
Well, this is part of the reason why I've doubled down into teaching civic education and teaching the history of how we got here in certain policies, how we got here in terms of our government structure. Because in order to
resist... And that's what you do, for people who don't know, that's what you do on your Sunday Civics podcast.
Yes, is to take the current political climate, give some history and context, but also then give you ways to be active and engaged in the issue or in the procedure, if it's a government procedure in that way. So for me, the resistance, in order to resist, you have to, yes, speak up, but then you also have to act. Mm-hmm. And so while your voice is being heard and while you are pushing back against the policies or other issues or even individuals who have a platform to display their bigotry, their racism, their sexism while they do that, then giving people the tools that they can actually act upon. And so while, yes, being part of the resistance is, you know, going to rallies and standing up and making your voice heard, there is also giving people hope and direction on where they can actually make change. And I think making that connection is important, because if you consistently tell people to speak up, they will then, that's why part of the reason why people are apathetic about participating in the process overall is they don't see any way to change it. They don't see any entry point that, well, my voice is going to be heard and somebody is going to act upon it. Just think about how, just reading the news every day and reading what Trump is doing every day. right? We hear him or we see him in meetings or making disparaging comments. And then think about you as an individual or even young people or others thinking, what avenue do I have to change or to impact what the president is saying in a meeting with lawmakers, what those lawmakers are going in a room and making a deal on immigration or other policy and legislation that affects our daily life. And so when you give people and empower people to raise their voices, to make sure that their voices are heard, you then have to give them the tools and the education for them to actually act upon that. So then they feel empowered to continue, and then they just don't burn themselves out.
Charles, resistance, anti-normalization, the right frame?
Well, let me take the word normalize, which I think was it has become overused because it is necessary to overuse it. That is the part that worries me the most, because I understand kind of basic human psychology and that outrage is exhausting, is an exhausting emotion. You simply cannot be sustained. It is required in the face of an assault. And we are now experiencing an assault on truth, an assault on decorum, an assault on protocol, just basic protocol, assault on kind of political and just human decency and etiquette. And trying to find a way to help people to negotiate that over the long haul, where so that it never starts to feel normal. You never turn on the television and say, "That's a lie. That's a lie. That's a lie." But that's just what he does, right? And I think that there's the human tendency is at some point to say, "This is just I have to adjust myself to this reality because it is real, and I have to find a way to survive it." And our survival mechanism is to turn down the volume of our outrage, and you know that's the scary thing to me.
Anybody else want to weigh in on that? I wonder, Catherine, if that's an obstacle to creating a second year of successful women's marches, that there's apathy out there, that people psychologically turn down the volume in the way that Charles was just saying, because it's so exhausting and it's on so many fronts at the same time. And how many things can we focus on at the same time to be outraged about? And so people kind of get a little numb and a little turned off. I mean, I'm throwing a lot of words out there, but how much is any of that an obstacle here at the beginning of year two?
The only obstacle I'm seeing is the apathy in the media for appetite to report on the Women's March. New York City, January 20th, we're going to be the largest march of the sister marches this year. We are almost at the same registration we had last year, about 80,000 people registered to attend Central Park West. But I want to come back to a point that you mentioned earlier on taking action and normalizing this. These Women's Marches are a shot of adrenaline. When you feel like I can't go on, and then you get there and you hear the crowd roaring around you, cheering you as a person on, you are more likely to continue. And so we recommend that you come out to these marches and realize you're not alone. Re-energize yourself. Feel the energy of people surrounding you that believe the same thing you believe, that we deserve equality, all genders.
You were quoted before last year's march, which you also organized here in New York, saying the march was not going to be anti-Trump,
yes.
It was pro-equality.
Yes.
So that's an accurate quote. And
yes.
How would you compare this year's march in that respect?
Same, pro-equality. And we had, I mean, look at what we're doing. We had so much success last year. So many women left their organizations that were underpaying them, either demanded equal pay, started their own organization, or came out stronger than ever simply because they marched and they realized, I have a voice, I'm not alone, and people will support me. Look at Me Too. I mean, women are coming out. They're realizing, I can say something, and people are listening. This is unheard of. I'm so excited about this year.
Murad, how much are you worried about and how much are you seeing at the New York Immigration Coalition when so many of the people that you represent feel so personally threatened and it is so visceral and is such a threat to themselves individually and to their families and to their neighbors and in ways that I think a lot of people who aren't personally in those situations certainly can't feel but maybe even don't get, that normalization is still an important enemy?
So just to answer this question, the one you mentioned before, I think the part about resistance and people resisting has been part of the immigrant rights movement since its inception. I don't think that Donald Trump came in and he became the first person to attack immigrants. President Barack Obama was titled the deporter in chief because he deported the most people in U.S. history from our country. So I think when we're talking about resisting and resistance, we've been doing that. I think that communities of color and low-income communities have always been at the forefront of resisting heinous policies, bigoted policies, and we're going to continue doing that. And what you can see is that our communities are extremely resilient. So there is this sense that people are being worn out because there's attack after attack after attack. And I think that that's intentional. Mm-hmm. The intent is really to wear down people, but we're not going anywhere. We're here to stay and we're going to continue to fight. I think the attack on individuals and it feeling extremely personal is right. Immigrants have, even when you look at it, Donald Trump's policies right now are really moving the conversation into him continuously talking about undocumented folks, but that's not who he's targeting. He's targeting everyone. Just last week, he rescinded TPS for over 200,000 El Salvadorians. He went forward and decided he was going to rescind DACA last year, and now this is why we're in the fight right now for the DREAM Act. So the attacks continue to come. As personal as it feels, people are still going to continue to stand up and fight back because this is everyone's livelihoods and keeping families together, which is pretty ironic when we're talking about the Republican Party, which is apparently about family values. So I think the resistance, as personal as it feels personal for everyone. Everyone wants to do something. A lot of our rallies and marches have really drawn out allies like we've never seen before. So people are standing up, speaking for themselves, impacted or not, coming because it is just wrong.
You know, to that point, if I can just add to that, your point about there being a level of resistance in this country, I would say even at the founding of this country. And it is marginalized groups in this country, the rights that we have as citizens and broadening what citizen is and broadening who Americans are is because of marginalized groups and people of color in this country, simply, right? The founding of this country was not, while the ideals of the language of the Constitution was inclusive, that is not what in reality played out. And even in thinking about Trump, I think we're so close because we're in the middle, we're only getting ready to be in year two, we're so close to this presidency, but putting it in an overall context in terms of resisting a president who is anti your life and your existence, we can think of, you know, just immediately Andrew Jackson and Andrew Johnson and others who had policies, who actually, you know, signed things into law to repeal the advancement of this of individuals and people of color in this country. So there is precedent for that. There, you know, the resistance has always existed in this country because we've always had to resist racist, sexist policies in this country because there is a certain type of who an American is and who a citizen is. And so it's playing a balance of being very mindful that we are fighting for our lives in the present term, and it is exhausting, and you do need a level of outrage on a daily basis to combat that issue. But then looking at it in over the course of our history and over the course of American history and knowing that there are presidents that existed that did either similar or worse things, and looking at those examples examples on how we can continue that onslaught is very important.
Listeners and Green Space audience members, for this special on the resistance at 1 year, how have you been resisting any aspect of Trumpism? What do you think is working or not working in the resistance? What would you like to see happen next? 212-433-WNYC if you're calling in, 212-433-9692, or if you're here in the green space, raise your hand and a producer will come around with a microphone for our guests, New York Times columnist Charles Blow, Catherine Semyonko, organizer of the first anniversary Women's March here in New York City this coming Saturday, L. Joy Williams, president of the Brooklyn NAACP, among other things, and Murad Awade, vice president of advocacy at the New York Immigration Coalition. And let's go to a caller right now. We're going to go to Anthony in Bedford, New York. Anthony, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling.
And I like to thank your guests because, you know, in December, my son got pulled over in Yonkers by police officers. And even though he had license, registration, insurance, they took him out of his car, searched him, made him take off his shoes, searched his car for allegedly marijuana, which he doesn't smoke. So I got 600 signatures up in Yonkers. And I'm filing a complaint with the Internal Affairs Division, but I couldn't get anyone to go up to that precinct and hold up signs with me. But I'm so outraged by what they did to my child, you know, I could cry. Because there was no reason to search my son. It was a cold December night. He was going to the train to pick up his girlfriend one block from our house. And to take off his shoes. They made him take off his shoes. You know, so I'm going to be at that march. You know, but you know what? Men need to be down with this too. You know, it is. There are so many outrages in this country going on, but to see that happen personally to your own child, to come home and tell me what happened to him, you know, I will not let this go. I don't care.
Anthony,
I'm not letting it go.
How do you make the connection between what Yonkers police may have done and the march against Trump and on those broader principles?
Because it's like being in a police state. These cops are emboldened because of Trump. I mean, to search my son's car the windows were up when he was driving. Their windows were up when he pulled them over. How do you smell marijuana, Ryan? How do you smell it in the air? So, yeah, it matters because, like the woman just said, it's about equality. They wouldn't treat a white kid like that in the office. Mm-mm. They would not do that.
Thank you.
Yeah, it does.
Anthony, thank you very much. Catherine?
So I spent about a decade in St. Louis, and if I drove through the wrong neighborhood with some of my friends who are black or Latino in the car, I would get pulled over, and they would ask if I was okay. So I understand what you're saying. This is a long-standing issue. And what's beautiful about this moment is we are now waking up. We are now coming together to say, you know what? I let that slide in the past. Not anymore. So I'm excited to see you there to show this administration that we're not going to put up with this anymore on Saturday, and know that you have my support.
Let's go to an audience question here in the green space. Hi.
Yes, hi. I am very critical about the media and the press. You know, someone, in fact, in media said that Trump is a symptom, but he's not the cause. And what angers me is that you have media people who still talk about his base, instead of giving people a civics lesson that if you're president, you're president of the United States of America, not the United Base of America. He's always the president for all the people. And what angers me about the media is that they talk about populism and all of a sudden populism always has a white face. So go back to Andrew Jackson, William Jennings Bryan. They don't even mention, I mean, we're not even on the screen. I am an advocate for public housing residents. Right now, we're fighting a thing that they just put up saying that they're violating the Fourth Amendment. They're going into your homes, and if you smoke in your apartments, I got a little strip they'll put on the window, see if you're smoking anything, and then you'll go down for eviction. And this is one of three things that started going back to Bill Clinton, because Bill Clinton signed QIRA. Does anybody know what QIRA is? Mm-hmm. QIRA says that if you didn't do community service, even if you were in college or even if you were early retiree, you had to do forced labor or you and your whole family would be evicted. That's still on the books. And Obama didn't get rid of it. In fact, Obama added RAD, which has made us mad. And it's a rental assistance demonstration that has in it a clause that if any public housing authority in the nation goes into default, all the buildings will be sold, well, they'll be given back to for-profit owners who are tax credits. Those buildings will be razed with a Z, and the people will be constructively evicted. The building owners, and there was even a fear that Trump owned my development of Lincoln, and there's this feeling that, well, they'll just build high-rise buildings, and if you can't afford it, well, out you go. So we have these three things that violates 13th, 14th, and 4th Amendments. I mean, what? Where can we get this information to the media? It's like they're interested in Pulitzer Prizes, but not, you know, how the other half lived, Jacob Riis. And so this is what we need to have done.
Thank you very much for getting some of that out. Charles, when he talks about the media...
He copes to me.
Well, you can talk about whatever you want, but you and I are the members of the media up here. And when he talks about the media focusing on the base too much, and he's not the president of the United States of the base, but the United States of America, it's a conundrum, because we don't want to give the base more press, more time, more power than they deserve. On the other hand, the political reality seems like Trump is the president of his base, and that's how he's cultivating his power. And that base is a large enough percentage of Republican America that the members of Congress who are Republicans are by and large too afraid of that base in their own districts in order to really speak out against, you know, the horrors of Trumpism. And I wonder how you see that.
I mean, I do believe that there's an overcompensation. People still regretting that they didn't have the right sense coming into the election to believe that he could win. And a lot of them being shocked the night that he did win. And the overcompensation for that is to go out and figure out what were the mechanisms that allowed him to win. That means that they keep going back to these same groups of people in these same delis and cafes and asking them the same questions, right? And so we see that over and over and over again. Now, as just as a person living in America, I already know these people. Like, I don't need to go and watch them eat, you know, scrambled eggs to know what they think. I already know what they think. However, people are not invested in returning constantly. You know, you see these serial kind of installments where they return and ask them about the latest thing that Trump did, and do you still support, not support? It's like a live poll sort of situation. The overall danger, another one of the dangers of Trump is that he sucks all the oxygen out of the room, right? So I can't tell you how many times I have wanted to write a different column about something else, you know, just because I'm exhausted by him. The next thing he does, I'm just required to say something because, you know, on some level, it is not small. No matter if he's tweeting something or if it's a policy issue, it's not small because it is the president of the United States doing that. Just because it's like some basest thing, some debased thing, and just because he throws it off on a social media platform, it doesn't make it small. It actually makes it bigger because he should not be doing that. And then I think about all of the power that that person possesses. And we have, the Constitution was set up to make so that the president, there was a basic expectation that the president would be an honorable, honest person. So they didn't build a lot of rules around it. Right? So he has a tremendous amount of power, and this was something that some of the founders actually worried about. Like, if you get, this is set up for somebody who's decent. What if you get somebody who's not decent with all this power? And the founders did not have, at that time, to worry about nuclear weapons, and they weren't worried so much about immigration, and they weren't, you know, their scope of worries was a lot smaller.
But they still set up checks and balances, at least on paper.
But even the checks and balances, like, all of this, I don't want to eat up all the time, but all of this is moving us into a slow motion constitutional issue, right? So we were set up in another way, we were set up to like protect places with small population, states with small populations. Mm-hmm. So it's everything's tilted that way. But the way we're moving in this country is that people are moving towards urbanization. This is a worldwide issue, but it's happening in this country as well. Since the 2010 census, you know, more and more young, white, college-educated people are moving to cities. But every time I see one show up in Brooklyn, I'm like, go back to where you came from. Because you, every time another person comes to one of these places, you're kind of just diluting that vote even more. And you're and the places that are being depopulated are getting stronger with every vote. And I always say, like, you know,
and they still get the same two senators.
Brooklyn has more people than the whole state of Alaska, but we will never have two senators. It's not set
right,
up that way.
Right, right. And as head of a Brooklyn NAACP, I often sometimes want to just put up a sign on all of the stop. No, just turn around, go back. We don't have any more space. But to your point, well, a couple of points. One, on the constitutional crisis in terms of the power of the presidency. And remembering that the presidency didn't always have as much power as it does, that has grown. And so for me, the constitutional crisis is, are we going to then shift to, which is already some conversation, about further narrowing the power of the presidency because of that? And you're right, they did have this fear, right, this back and forth. They didn't want to create a king. They didn't want to create, sort of mirror the same thing that they wanted to. And the presidency was supposed to be this aspirational post, which is the reason why the first president was who he was, right? It was somebody who everybody liked, looked up to, you know, was the symbol, right? And not necessarily the person who did as much as we have presidents do currently.
And ordinary people didn't get a chance to vote for him, by the
exactly.
way.
Exactly. I always tell people, you have a representative vote for president, not a direct vote. So, and actually, you don't actually have a constitutional right to vote, but, you know, that's a whole separate episode of my show. But, you know, the conversation of media and the Trump consistently sucking things out of the room has impacted me personally. So I now cut off news and media after 9 a.m. in the morning.
Oh, very good.
So between I would
recommend noon.
Okay. Well, you know, some things you can listen to on demand later. But so, and not that I recommend this for everyone, right? This may not be recommendation, but as someone who is consistently, like, I feel the need to activate or act on things that you hear, like to be outraged by something someone tweeted or posted or a different story or a hot take analysis or things like that. So I set up for myself Twitter hours and like sort of news hours so that I can work and think in between. And then come back and sort of read later. And it's precisely because the mainstream media, and I don't want to label all media because I also listen and read alternate forms of media than, you know, the regular CNN, MSNBC, and all of that, and Times and Post. But to think about media in a different way. So we rage against media as consistently following everything that the president does, but that's their job, right? Their job is to report and analyze and things of that nature. But to maybe also broaden our definition of who media is and reading and watching other forms of it that allows us time to think and process. Just think about even in your own individual jobs, how much time do you build in to your day to actually think about something, to actually work on the issue? Or are you just going from meeting to event to, you know, and so you're just going from one thing to another and don't have time to process and think. And because he is such a person who sucks everything out of the room, you'll find yourself spinning and spinning and spinning on what he said, what he tweeted, what he wrote, what he didn't say, what he reportedly said, that it contributes to you feeling this is too much and I'm overburdened. So maybe, I know for me personally, I've had to take breaks, right? And not that I'm not consistently resisting or finding a way, but you have to take breaks to actually think about things in context. We don't have time to think that much anymore.
We'll continue in a minute with our 1 year of the resistance special, the Brian Lehrer Show, live in the green space today, 212-433-WNYC. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. We are live in the green space today for our special edition, The Resistance at 1 Year. Our first hour guests, New York Times columnist Charles Blow, Catherine Simbianco, organizer of last year's Women's March here in New York, and now of the first anniversary Women's March here in New York this coming Saturday, Eljoy Williams, national political strategist, social justice activist, president of the Brooklyn NAACP, and host of the Sunday Civics podcast, and Murad Awade, vice president of advocacy at the New York Immigration Coalition. And a reminder, listeners, when we're in the green space, you can see the show as well as listen, because we're set up here for live streaming video. So if you want to watch, go to thegreenspace.org. That's green with an E at the end, thegreenspace.org, or WNYC.org, and you can see us as we talk. And you can call in 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. So I'm curious for each of you, kind of what's worked and what hasn't worked, or how have you even decided this year what to organize around first, and what means of resistance to use? Because from the travel ban to dismantling environmental laws to ending an Obama protection for women who were being paid less than the equivalent men in their workplace. Did you know about that one? They can't don't have the same protection to share their income data, to pick a million other things. How do you even choose your targets and how to respond? Murad?
I think we have to respond, and we've tried to respond as much as possible. Sometimes it's about the level of impact that our members will be facing. So when, you know, Donald Trump hit the ground running when he came into office with signing a ton of executive orders within the first week, that he was in office, and one of them was, which people don't quite remember, doubling ICE enforcement agents, doubling Customs and Border Patrol agents, as well as, you know, demanding that the border wall be funded. You can't do that in executive order. I don't think he knew that yet. After that, immediately, he signed the Muslim ban executive order, which again, illustrated the incompetence of this administration and the people around him, because it was written extremely discriminatory, and every court that saw it said the same thing, that this is, you know, false flat on discrimination, and this is what it is. You are discriminating against the group based on their religion. And the first, our first big mobilization once he was in office was when we mobilized to JFK and started the national protest at the airports. That was something that you just can't not respond to when you have people detained and on their way to be deported from the country when they're green card holders or were holders of other visas. You know, and folks tend to think back to the Muslim ban and think of the two Iraqi individuals who were translators for the U.S. Army. I think that that just shows you, while they were not the only folks who were detained, there was about 12 of them and a number of others, hundreds of others, who were questioned for hours on end, that there was no real process that they were following. They didn't know what they were doing. Even at CBP, they were like, we didn't get any guidance. What are we supposed to be doing? So they took it upon themselves to make that decision. So I think when we look at what he did to when he rescinded DACA, we had to respond. It's not like we had the option not to. We're talking about over 800,000 young people across the nation, 50,000 of whom live in New York State. I think it comes down to how his policy is going to impact locally, and what that looks like. Even with ACA repeal and replace, which they didn't have a replacement for a while, we kept mobilizing because a lot of people need health care. Everyone deserves health care, and what they were doing was trying to strip people of their right to have health care. And I think that it's not based on like a metrics, honestly. It's based on how many people are going to be impacted and how does our membership as a coalition feel about the current situation.
And then who's the target of the activism? Is it the wider public by going into the streets or to the airports and trying to get TV cameras there and raise public awareness? Or how much is it members of Congress? I mean, Charles was talking about the self-sorting that our population is doing before into red areas and blue areas, it's probably pointless to some degree for you to approach a senator from Oklahoma. I don't know, I'm picking a state kind of a random, maybe it's not fair. Or do you target, there are obviously swing districts, you know, places where there are Republican House members, where Hillary Clinton won the presidential vote and things like that. How specifically do you target?
I think if we go back and have an example, let's look at the Muslim ban. The target was Donald Trump. What we wanted to do is raise awareness to the general public what was happening, because when he signed it at like almost 5 o'clock at night on a Friday, which was intentional because it's like, hey, let's dump it. Let's get it over with. It'll unravel. We'll figure out what happens on the weekend. Who wants to go out on a weekend and protest? Excuse me. So he was the target, and the tactics that we used was about informing people. And in the informative phase, it's also informing members of Congress. So Congressman Nydia Velazquez and Congressman Gerald Nadler made it out to the airport because of the uproar that was happening. And they came very early in the beginning of the uproar, so it wasn't even like they needed the 10,000 people who showed up at the airport to come. They were there when it was just like four people. So I think that the optics of what was happening was needed because we needed to raise awareness. And then literally a day later, the Trump administration came back and was like, whoa, we didn't mean to do this in this manner. Green card holders can come in.
Right.
So
the pushback worked. In fact, and let me stay with you for one more question before we move down the row. It might have been in Michael Wolff's book, but I'm not sure, where Steve Bannon was quoted as saying, we purposely did this on a Friday. After other people said, why'd you do it on a Friday? It's the weekend. People are free to show up at the airports. And the Bannon and then presumably Trump approach was that they were going to goad the resistance into what a lot of the public would see as overreacting. And the resistance would be seen worse than the policy, and they would win. Do you keep anything? Obviously, that did not happen in that case, or maybe not so obviously.
Bad strategy.
But
do you keep it in mind at that strategic level?
I think they are going to, again, throw everything at us at the same time. So I'm not shocked that that's in that book. I haven't read it yet, and that's hilarious. But the Saturday, it was a Saturday morning. It was freezing. It was like one of the coldest days last year. It reminded me, actually, I had flashbacks of that day when we had like the Arctic freeze in New York City last week. But I do think that they're not, even if they try to goad us, we're still going to stand up. And if it's something wrong, we're going to stand up against it. So I do think that there is this, they don't understand civil rights. And I think that's what it comes down to, right? So if you don't understand what rights people have, and I'm not even saying this comically, I'm saying this honestly, they don't understand what the Constitution stands for. They don't understand what rights we have. They just think that he's the president, he can do whatever. And I think that the checks and balances are not strong enough, honestly. But there are some there right now that are really going to hold them accountable. And those are, for us, it's been the courts, because Congress is out, right? So looking at how we've reacted, it's all not been part of this grand scheme resistance that everyone keeps talking about. That we've all come together and we've sat down and we've discussed, what are we going to do when he does this? A lot of it has been, we hear this is happening. How should we respond? And the other thing is, when they thought that the public would like, it would be backlash on folks coming out to resist, what did they think we were going to do, tear down the airport? I think that that's their mentality. And it's honestly a very white supremacist mentality. One that thinks that everyone else is uncivilized. Everyone else is an animal. We are the civilized ones. We need everyone else to be expelled. And that's just not going to work here, because this is a country of immigrants.
Joy, you start to say bad strategy by Bannon?
Yeah, from a political strategy point, that's just horrible. I haven't read the book, and I have no intentions of doing so. But just from that particular snippet, that's just completely bad strategy from that point. Totally underestimating the power of, you know, advocates. Totally underestimating media and their ability to capture just just bad from that standpoint.
And so how have you picked your spots this year as, let's say, in your role as Brooklyn NAACP president? Yeah. Almost everybody in Brooklyn probably agrees with you on most things. So
no. and I can tell you why. So from Brooklyn and NAACP, so I'm doing this on both fronts. So, you know, with Sunday Civics, why do I keep knocking this down? So on Sunday Civics, obviously teaching the civic education. But from a Brooklyn and NAACP standpoint, you know, this is part of our mission. It's what we do all the time. And so what we've been doing is those who are interested or have just become politically aware, rolling them into the work that we've already been working on, and specifically targeting the city council and the state legislature, in reminding people that we still live in a states' rights country, right? And so for a large portion of what we can change, where you have a direct vote, is on the state and local level. And so educating people about that process and then harnessing that energy that people have from a march, from other resistance activities, to then showing them how you can make change on a state and local level. And that's very important, because a lot of people don't understand the connection that some of the things that they are resisting against or that they want to see changed is at the state and local level. And so we've been harnessing that power to do that. We have this Saturday for our members, we have an annual organizing meeting where we're again training people on that process to be part of what we're doing in challenging on the state and local level. And living in a place like New York, you would imagine, oh, New York is this progressive mecca and everything is great and we have a progressive mayor and a progressive governor and the legislature and everything, but the state legislature is controlled by Republicans. Right. People think of New York and you think of New York City and not think about all of upstate and then the rest of New York. Right. So there is still resistance. And no matter how, quote, progressive the mayor or progressive the governor is, we still have to fight and push them to do the right thing that they travel all across the country and say that they do on a regular basis.
Did you say you have Saturday organizing sessions? How do people get involved with that? So, for
Saturday, the January 27th, if you're a member of Brooklyn NAACP, and NAACP is membership is $30, so you spend that at Duane Reade, so don't even worry about it, right? When you're a member of Brooklyn NAACP, and then we invite you to come and be part of the planning process, right? So NAACP is one of the only organizations where you can pay your $30 and join and be a leader and participate in that aspect. And so we invite people to become to come be a members and help lead these efforts in going to Albany here in New York, going to City Hall to advocate on these issues. We were just instrumental in helping to pass two bills. One, we didn't like so much the end, but, you know, two bills on the Right to Know Act, holding police officers accountable in the work that they do here so that they have to show you ID or tell you why they're stopping you. And at the same time, get in your consent to actually search you. So the brother that called in about his son being stopped, right? We're talking about legislation that it would affect. I mean, this was on a city level, but also we could do that on a state level. How police officers, how law enforcement is interacting with our community on a daily basis. So those are instances where you can have a direct say, your direct vote, right? Because you're voting for the mayor, you're voting for city council. Now this year, you'll be voting for the state legislature and the governor and going on, but then also changing policy and legislation that has a direct effect on your day-to-day life.
Let's go to another caller. We're going to go to Sue Ellen in Red Bank. Sue Ellen, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling in.
Hi, Brian. How are you today?
Okay, thank you.
I wanted to talk about an organization in Red Bank that we started right after the election last year. Everyone was, you know, it's a familiar story. Everyone was in despair and wondering what to do. We started with 12 people meeting in my living room, and we've grown now to have an email list at least of over 500 members. We have a great webpage, a great Facebook page, and what I see has happened in the past year is that we have evolved from thinking that we would be part of the resistance to really emphasizing the importance of building resilient communities and helping our local and state institutions survive the Trump presidency, which we hope will end in 3 years. And it's also been an opportunity for women who have been well-informed all their lives, but maybe not politically active, to get involved. And it's just, I say the only good thing that happened because of the Trump presidency.
Sue Ellen, you come back to something that Joy was just referencing and that we have heard time and time again on this show, starting, I think, the very day after the election or a couple of days after the election last year when Anna Marie Cox was on and saying, so what do we do now? Organize at the hyper-local level. Go out there and run for school board. And honestly, I chuckled when she said run for school board. Oh, we have this global threat, Donald Trump at the White House, and you're saying run for school board. But she and a million others have chimed in and said, no, it's really about community organizing, developing strong, like you say, resilient communities. Change starts at the local level. And look what's happened from a Democratic Party perspective in the states and state legislatures and governorships over the last 10 years or so. The Dems have lost one after one after one after one while focusing on national politics and ignoring the local. So thank you very much for your call. And just wanted to put a period on that, that is coming up over and over and over again is so important. Let's go to another Green Space audience member. Hi.
Hi. I want to first thank Brian for the show, and I also want to commend all the panelists here for what you have done. I'm a reader, and I go to the march and do whatever I can. But I'm also an immigrant, and I'm throwing sort of unfairly another challenge to you to see how we can do in this lack of oxygen atmosphere to convey and correct the misinformation that's been thrown out of there. I'll give you this one very particular example. For this chain migration, when I saw the TV ad, it scared you, but you start with one immigrant and then pretty quickly you have 2,700 immigrants coming, which is totally untrue. I am an immigrant myself. I went through all the process. There are different priorities that for the merit-based ones, you have once you get a quota, depending on which country you are from, you may have to wait for 5-7 years. And for the ones of family reunification, you may have to wait for 10-20 years to get there. So from one to get to 2,700, it takes several hundred years to get there. So how do we make that information, send that information to the general public, to the base, for them to understand it's not that scary?
Murad from the New York Immigration Coalition, do you want to take that?
Yeah, I think that that's something that we try to do. And I think we are always trying to have people and highlight people who are telling their stories. Unless you're indigenous, you are not native to these lands. Everyone came here from somewhere. And I think that we try to come back to that. But then at the same time, we don't want to erase the atrocities that this country has done, because they did take the land from the natives, and then they also enslaved people and brought them here to work the land. But telling our own stories about what our family immigration system has been, I think education's a huge deal with it as well. And I think when we do it, we just need people to elevate it and amplify, because, you know, we don't have a media shop in our organization. And, you know, when this also comes back to the media, is like people are looking at what's the worst thing he just said or tweeted, as opposed to wanting to get informed and informing people of the truth, being the fact checkers that are supposed to be informing us as a general public. And I think that that's one thing that we can do, is like visit our social media pages. We are always putting out fact sheets. We're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. And I think that the piece here that I just want to end with is there's a big role within the media that should be telling these stories too, and they're not. And they just continuously are repeating what he's saying and not giving the counter to it either. And it's like people are defending what he says on some networks as well, where it's like, yes, we need to end this because look, how many people are here from this one country? It's like, there's over 270 million Americans in the country. Like, what are you talking about? You're talking about 10,000 people? I think that that's the piece that needs to happen as well.
Catherine, you wanted to get in on that?
Yeah, I want to say that we're talking a lot about fatigue. We're talking a lot about negative, focusing on Trump. Let's start being pro, right? Pro equality, pro women, pro whatever it is, fill in the blank for you, right? Instead of anti. And when we look at the media is so focused on defending Trump or hating on Trump. Let's start focusing on the issues. Let's start educating ourselves on what we need to do to move forward. I'll give you an example. Women's March Alliance, our nonprofit, did 22 events last year. That's massive for a brand new organization. And this year we realized, you know what? We don't want to be reactive to whatever comes out. We want to be proactive. So we are supporting women voting and registering to vote. Your vote is the best way to be proactive. And your vote matters when you yourself take the time to be educated on the issues and the people that you're voting for.
And Charles, you wrote in your latest column that racism doesn't require hatred or even conscious awareness. And the acknowledgement that Trump is a racist is the easy part. Yeah. The harder, more substantive part is, what are we going to do about it? That's the resistance, you wrote. So where do you start to answer your own question?
Well, first I'll say this. I admire these amazing people. They're activists. I am not, right? And on purpose. I am in journalism. And I see my role as bearing witness, and that requires some distance, even from the things you care about. And in that role, one thing that I try to impress upon people is that the federal government is a behemoth. It is enormous, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and thousands of people working as they show up every day and they do things, right? So whatever area that you are an activist in, there's somebody every day showing up active in that space. And if they're doing, and if they're under the leadership of someone who is hostile to your interests, they're active in opposition to your interests every day, right? And although I do believe, and media is a tricky term for me because I think of media very broadly, but even at the big mainstream media places, because I have to do a lot of reading for columns, when I read through the New York Times or the Washington Post or Politico or New York CNN.com, they actually have covered all these things. It's just that it's not covered on television, because there are only so many words you can say in an hour, and they're trying to figure out what are the top 10 things that we can cover in this 1 hour. So you're only going to get the top 10 things, and some people try to get there from comedy shows where they only make show the things that they can make fun of. So that's three things that they can make fun of, and so it's if you look at media in that frame, you're only going to get a narrow slice. If you look at there's 1,200 people in the New York Times, there are people whose beat it is to just do immigration or just do kind of women's focused things or just do environment. And they do, because it's their job too to show up every day and do something. And they do record these things. It's just that they never rise because there's so much other stuff happening. So when I'm thinking about writing, I realize I could go down into each one of these holes, but it's just so much. So I stay at a different level. And the altitude that I try to stay at is trying to remind people to constantly ask themselves this question: what kind of country do you want to live in? Right? Is it inclusive? Is it open? Is it loving? Is it moving forward to a more open, egalitarian society or not? And if you believe that right now we are not, you have an obligation to, number one, acknowledge that that is the case. Number two, to say to everybody, particularly in your, like what I call your sphere of influence, the people who are closest to you are the people who you have the most impact on. Everybody around you, you should be proselytizing to them about how you feel, what are they gonna do, what are you doing right now? All of that is really important. And then to say, you have to show up every time you vote. I mean, I love the energy of protest, but I know that that is not a vote, mm-hmm. right? It is not a vote, and people feel great when they do it. You know, the first caller was talking about, basically, that was the Black Lives Matter issue, right? It was police violence against people of color. I talked ad nauseum before the election about this issue. How can you show up and be tear gassed and not show up and cast a ballot? Like it was painful for me to watch that happen, because I know that all police precedents about how you interact with people is set in the courts, right? That's how we got Miranda rights. Even the things you pass on a local level, if it is fought, right, it's going to go through the courts as high as it can go, and that's where the precedent will be set, mm-hmm, right? And I'm thinking, that's how everything that's happening that you're thinking about that's happening to these kids on the street is because of it's legal. That's why it's, yep, nobody's going to jail, because it's legal, because the courts have said this is how we want people to behave. There is an open Supreme Court seat, justice seat, right now. You have to show up. And I kept running into people who said, I'm protesting the whole system. The whole system is corrupt, and I refuse to participate in any way. So that becomes where I try to stay at this higher level to say, what kind of society do you want to live in? And if you want to live in a different society, then this is how we make it different.
And wow. You vote for it.
Before, Catherine, you get the last word, which you will, with the second annual Women's March in New York coming up this weekend. I'll just preserve our FCC license by saying this is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. Those of you in the green space seeing me read that, you might think I would have memorized it by now, but no. We are New York and New Jersey Public Radio. Catherine, in a minute, I want you to tell everybody if they want to participate how and where, but I want to get your comment on the article in the Times today, headlined, 1 year after the Women's March, more activism but less unity, about two strands of the women's resistance movement kind of competing and factionalizing, Women's March, Inc., based here, I don't know if you're officially with that, and the other group, March On, which seems to be more decentralized and more focused, almost to Charles' point at the end there, on elections in red states, where they say the Women's March protest techniques have not been as popular or effective. And I'm curious, I'm not interested in sowing the seeds of division at all. I'm curious how you see the interplay between Women's March, Inc. and March On working differently toward the same goals in different parts of the country, or anything you'd want to say about that.
So first I want to say all of the women's marches, there is no central leadership. There is no central funding. We are like public libraries. Every single one of us is unique. Women's March Alliance is here in New York. Chicago has their own, Boston, Dallas. Everybody has their own little niche. And that is a beautiful setup, because women's rights in Alabama and their needs are very different from the rights of those in Chicago, in LA, in San Francisco. And so we're set up and we're very local. The groups that you're talking about, Women's March, which are, they organized DC only last year. They didn't organize everything else, just DC. And then you have March On, who is acting as a connective tissue to make sure we're all communicating and talking as sister marches. These groups are focusing on keeping the awareness in the press. And I wish them all the luck in that. There's no negative energy amongst us all. It's just that we're like public libraries. We're all separate. But as far as this Saturday, there are more than 280 national marches this year. New York is going to be the biggest. So come on out to New York Saturday, January 20th. The rally starts at 11 a.m. We are taking over all of Central Park West from 61st. As far up as we need to go. So you can enter. The main entrance will be on 71st and Columbus, between Columbus and Central Park West. So come on out.
It is our 1 year of the Resistance special here in the green space today on the Brian Lehrer Show. Please thank Catherine Semyonko, L. Joy Williams, Barada Wada, and Charles Blow.